I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times.
Died for him. Me, I trusted him.
Me, I loved him.
And me, I'm the damn fool that shot him.
There's a million things I haven't done. Just you wait.
What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton.
That familiar song is from the musical Hamilton, sung by Leslie Odom Jr., who grew up in Philadelphia and plays Aaron Burr, Hamilton's rival. This hip-hop take on one of the more forgotten founding fathers won 11 Tonys on Sunday, has received raves from critics, and is a huge hit with the public. Good luck getting a ticket anytime soon. It was written and composed by Lin-Manuel Miranda, who was inspired by Ron Chernow's biography of the poor immigrant from the Caribbean who became the country's first Treasury Secretary. And while the musical celebrates his restless ambitions and many achievements, does it gloss over the more controversial aspects of Alexander Hamilton, including his mistrust of democracy? Well, today on Radio Times, what Hamilton gets right and wrong about Alexander Hamilton. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Louis Mazur, and he's a professor of American Studies and History at Rutgers University. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. And joining us by telephone is Mallory Kara. She covers entertainment for Bustle.com. And Mallory, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I should say we have all seen Hamilton, and let me just begin and put this on the record. I loved it. I thought it was exciting theater. I thought it was brilliantly performed. The choreography was fabulous. I thoroughly enjoyed it top to bottom. So I don't want anyone to think that we are ripping this thing apart. I want to give you a chance, Lou, to weigh in on this as well.
Absolutely. The shows get so much hype, and you go and you think they can't possibly live up to the hype, but this one does. And as a historian especially, anything that's going to make American history this compelling to so many people has to be doing something right.
Two thumbs up, right?
Exactly.
Mallory, you want to weigh in on that as well?
Absolutely. This is one of the most electrifying shows on Broadway currently and has revitalized a good amount of musical theater in general. Just every listen, even after seeing the show, even every listen of the cast recording, you were discovering something new about history, about the characters, and about just life in general.
Let me go back to you, Lou, only because I've been slowly reading through Ron Chernow's biography of Alexander Hamilton. It's a huge tome that he has written. But nonetheless, what I also found so interesting is how Miranda used some of the language, some of the stories, what he kept in, what he did not include in the musical. I thought that was also quite a brilliant use of this original work.
Yeah, and even within the play itself, he had to shorten it from its original appearance at the Public Theater. In fact, one of the things that people do not fully understand coming away from the play is Hamilton's tortured relationship with John Adams. But he had to create a narrative line. It's a play. It's not a work of history. So there are some inventions, narrative inventions, especially with the relationship with Burr. But it's absolutely brilliant how much material he was able to compress into a short period of time.
So what should we know about Alexander Hamilton, the man? I'm looking at you, Lou.
Well, what I think the play is brilliant about and the book is brilliant about is to recognize Hamilton as the self-made man in America. He's not the only self-made man in America, but the hungry immigrant, the man of ambition, the guy who's not going to throw away his shot, as the play says over again. I mean, that's absolutely right. And this is a kid who's 14 years old, comes to America, and from being a bastard orphan from the West Indies, rises to the heights that he rises. That's a great story. That's an American story, and that's the emphasis of the play.
How do you see Alexander Hamilton to you, Mallory?
I see that. I agree, actually. I agree. I have also been slowly making my way through Ron Chernow's biography. It is very, very comprehensive.
Yes, it is.
But it's amazing how much, even after seeing the show, how much of it is translated so well into the show. And I think Lin-Manuel Miranda has that pinned down, even with translating some of that into rap, into different musical styles, and that he's taking this character of Alexander Hamilton, who is ambitious, he is about getting it right and not throwing away his shot and translating that into these songs, into his mind speeding up. One of the passages that always resonated with me was how fast Alexander Hamilton was thinking and thought, and how much he wrote, and how well Lin-Manuel Miranda was able to translate that into the character and within the songs of the musical.
Well, in fact, at some point, one of the characters says to Alexander Hamilton, just stop talking.
Right, no. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, just stop. Right.
Well, he was known for walking around talking out loud to himself. I mean, there was a maniacal element to Hamilton. I mean, the great thing about the play is it makes Hamilton likable in a way in which there's lots of reasons to think he wasn't that likable a character, and that's part of the amazing thing about the revival.
Well, why wasn't he so likable? I mean, it seemed like he had enemies, or he certainly created people that did not like him very much.
Oh, my goodness, on both sides of the political platform. I mean, he destroys the Federalist Party, his own party, as much as he destroys the Republican Party. You know, there's something about him that he believed he was right. And when he believed he was right, he was tenacious about that position. You know, he was one of those people, ask for a 10-page letter, you got a 50-page letter. And that relentlessness made enemies.
Well, and I'm also thinking, Mallory, I think we're all describing that the Hamilton that's in Hamilton is ambitious and driven and restless and all of that. And that is a kind of a stereotype that we have of Americans, or maybe even immigrants to America. They're here because of that kind of restlessness. Can you add to that, Mallory?
Sure. I think there's a hunger. There's a hunger when you come to this country and, you know, as an immigrant, and you want to do something with your life. You have dreams, you have passions. I'm the child of I'm a second generation Italian American, as well as being a first generation born Chinese, half Chinese American.
Oh, wow.
And I know when my grandparents and when my mother came to this country, they were very passionate about, they wanted to live free, they had dreams, and that they wanted to do. And I think that is something that is really well reflected in Hamilton, that he's not going to throw away his shot because he is here, he has dreams. He the birth of this nation was coming from a dream he had, that he knows he wrote himself out of a horrible situation where he was left as an orphan. And he got out of that situation. He knew that life was short.
Yeah.
And he saw that time was of the essence.
I mean, it is in many ways, Lou, it is an immigrant story. And one of the lines from the play is, you know, immigrants, we get the job done.
That's right. It's an immigrant story, excuse me, but it's also a tragedy. I mean, part of that, and it's not just the way his life ends. I mean, toward the end of his life, he says, every day proves to me more and more that this American world was not made for me.
Yeah.
That's an astonishing statement. And in some ways, while he won, his vision of America won to a certain extent, that capitalist investment, manufacturing, banking vision. In other ways, by 1800, with the election of Jefferson, he felt he had lost.
Yeah.
And that the America that he was witness to the creation of really went in a very different way.
There is some question about his parentage, whether he was biracial, or do we know, Lou, do we have enough information to be able to decide that or not?
Not really. There's speculation about biracial. There's speculation about Jewish ancestors in the family, right? His mother's original marriage was to someone who was Jewish. We don't really know.
Yeah, yeah. He does come to America. He's a young man looking for his fortune, I guess, to find his identity. And in many ways, it is a story, Mallory, about this country and how Alexander Hamilton in many ways sort of represents this sort of young and hungry country that's coming into being.
Absolutely. And I think what kind of resonates the most about that is in the first half, where you have John Lawrence, you have Hercules Mulligan, you have Alexander Hamilton palling around together, dreaming this dream together. And I know from Hamilton, the Revolution, Ron Chernow did tell Lin-Manuel Miranda that some of those people would not become part of Hamilton's life until later on. But Lin-Manuel Miranda liked the idea of having these four friends together, dreaming the dream of this new country and this new way of life for them.
Lou, one of the things that you say that we should think about Alexander Hamilton, and we think of him as one of our founding fathers,
right.
But you say in many ways he's really the founding father of Wall Street, which tells us, I think, a whole lot more about this
man. There's
no
doubt about it. And that's where the battle becomes engaged. I mean, this is a man who, more than the founding father of Wall Street, right, he believed in government. And government is a real issue in the 18th century as it is today. How much government should there be in people's lives? So even before what he does with Wall Street, right, the Constitution of the United States, he plays a pivotal role in creating a document that gives more power to the federal government. It invents, in effect, the national government. And then as Secretary of the Treasury, he creates the machinery for that government, the infrastructure related to banking, to service of debt, to borrowing, to securities exchanges.
All this, very familiar things that we think about today.
Exactly. And in that sense, he was way ahead of his time. That, you know, the opposition political party opposed all of this.
Right.
They dreaded banks. They feared banks. They feared centralized authority. The reason why, and the play is brilliant on this, right? The reason why our capital ends up in Washington, D.C. is Hamilton makes a political compromise. He can't get his bill on public credit passed because the Southern Republicans won't vote for it. He strikes a deal that if they vote for it, he'll agree to move the capital closer to the Southerners. And that tells us something else as well, that the idea that government can't be trusted. So physically, we want to be close to it to keep an eye on it.
Well, a historian, actually, who's at Princeton University, said we should think of Hamilton more as the 1% than the 99%.
Without any question.
And you're saying without any question.
Well, certainly someone who thought for and about, if not the 1%, the 10%.
The elites, I guess.
The elite, the moneyed people, the bankers, the merchants, the people who he believed, the creditors, the people who he believed had an investment in helping to build and make the country. He was very suspicious of the people.
Yes. And Mallory, I think that this is one criticism. We're almost up in a break here, whether he comes off as a bigger, perhaps populist in Hamilton than he was in real life.
I think so. I think there's a lot of his ego. There's a lot of ego there. There is a lot of him being a very large figure. And I think it balances out in the musical because we do see his rise in the first half. And then in the second half, we see him fall a little bit.
Right.
We see his enemies. We see his sex scandal come about. So I think it balances out with his faults as well. And like you had said, there are people in the musical who do say, can you stop talking for a second?
So exactly. I love that, actually.
He does have faults. He's not seen as someone who is completely perfect.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking about what the musical, the hip-hop musical, Hamilton, gets right and gets wrong about Alexander Hamilton. All three of us lucky enough to have seen this play, and we all enjoyed it. But there are some questions raised about the depiction of Alexander Hamilton. Talking with Mallory Kara and Louis Mazur, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. We're talking about Hamilton, the musical, and Alexander Hamilton, our first Treasury Secretary. Here's another clip from the musical Hamilton, My Shot, sung by the show star and author Lin-Manuel Miranda.
I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. You know, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. To King's College, I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, I'm amazed and astonished. The problem is I got a lot of brains but no polish. I gotta holler just to be heard with every word I drop knowledge. I'm a diamond in the rough, a shining piece of coal, trying to reach my goal. My power of speech unimpeachable. Only 19, but my mind is older. These New York City streets get cold. I shoulder every burden, every disadvantage I've learned to manage. I don't have a gun to brandish. I walk these streets famished. The plan is to fan this spark into a flame, but damn, it's getting. So let me spell out the name. I am the A-L-E-X-A-N-D-E-R. We are meant to be a colony that runs independently. Meanwhile, Britain keeps f***ing on us endlessly. Essentially, they tax us relentlessly. Then King George turns around, runs a spending spree. He ain't never gonna set his descendants free. So there will be a revolution in this century. Enter me.
He says it parentally.
And that's Lin-Manuel Miranda from the musical that he wrote and stars in, My Shot. And again, talking with Mallory Kara, who covers entertainment for Bustle.com. Also, Louis Mazur with us, professor of American Studies and History at Rutgers University, talking about our first Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton. And, of course, this play that won, I think, 11 Tonys on Sunday night. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Lou, let me go back to you, and let's talk a little bit about the relationship between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. First of all, how it's depicted in the play and how it was in real life.
Well, it's a great moment in the play, without giving anything away, no spoilers here,
no.
But when David Diggs, who plays Jefferson, shows up really in Act Two, and he's back from France, and that's an important part of the story. Jefferson is away from much of this history of the formation of the Constitution. He finally comes back and enters Washington's cabinet. The two of them don't meet for the first time until 1790 in New York. And at first, you know, there's some sympathies between them. But in Washington's cabinet, they just go at it day after day after day. Jefferson said they were pitted against each other like two cocks. They just
Was it personality, politics, all of the above?
It's political philosophy. It really is. Jefferson called Hamilton the evil genius of this country, that they fundamentally had diametrically opposed visions of America. You know, if you walk – sometimes when I lecture, I ask an audience who sees themselves as Hamiltonian, who sees themselves as Jeffersonian. And they just battled over and over again. And Washington – was sort of the father figure who they each kept appealing to. There are these letters that they write to Washington that are astonishing, in which they're whining and complaining about each other.
Like sons, right?
Oh, it's incredible. And I think what breaks Jefferson's heart is Washington ultimately takes Hamilton's side and sort of becomes a Federalist. He endorses the National Bank. The Republicans hate banks. They fear banks. The idea of the bank is something to encourage debt, and debt they thought was a cancer. So it's really this fundamental antagonistic vision, a vision that ultimately is going to play out in politics over the next 10 years.
Absolutely. Mallory, anything you want to add to that, looking at this relationship between Hamilton and Jefferson?
I think what it gives us in the musical is those incredible rap battles, as well as that entire riveting second half where we get this group of songs in which we think we're seeing Hamilton's downfall with the sex scandal and many of his own contemporaries turning against him. And I think what the musical does is great is that it gives Hamilton an antagonist in Burr, but it gives him kind of a secondary antagonist in Jefferson, where you're wondering, are they on the same side or are they just two brilliant men who just keep knocking heads together.
But if we're going to talk about the sort of the reality moment, Mallory, you're absolutely right. The play does that. In truth, Jefferson was the primary antagonist. I mean, it was the two of them. The relationship with Burr is more complicated. I mean, Chernow's book is very good on the relationship with Burr. In fact, the two of them were, in many ways, had a lot in common. They worked together.
They lived kind of parallel lives, did they not?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They worked together on law cases. That the split between them that becomes really antagonistic doesn't happen until really the late 1790s in some ways. And a third antagonist in all this is John Adams, and that's left out of the story entirely. But so not only does Hamilton publish a pamphlet in which he admits to having an affair, he then publishes a pamphlet denouncing John Adams, in which he just essentially commits political suicide by doing so.
And those two men hated each other, yes?
Perhaps even worse than Hamilton and Jefferson, and they were the same political party.
Let me ask you just something really quickly. We've actually done whole shows, certainly about Thomas Jefferson. Obviously, the embodiment of our original sin as a slave owner and holder, who also had these lofty ideas about liberty.
Right.
And it's interesting to compare him and Alexander Hamilton, this immigrant, scrappy immigrant who didn't have a lot of money coming to this country, but later became suspicious of immigrants. I mean, it's such an interesting sort of opposite side of the same coin in a way.
Yeah, there really is. And it's not useful to use the word hypocrisy, but there's a certain element of that in both of their lives. Jefferson, the man of the gentry, who said incredible things, who wrote the line, all men are created equal, and let live the life on the top of Monticello, oblivious to it. And yeah, I mean, one of the moments that is about the real Hamilton is in 1796 or so, Adams' administration passes the Alien and Sedition Acts, which are a series of laws designed to extend the period that it would take for somebody to become a citizen, to allow the government to deport anyone who wasn't a citizen, who was opposing government policies, to allow the muzzling of newspapers. Hamilton comes out in favor of this.
Yes, yes. Does that, I mean, from what you know and we know about him, does that seem surprising at that time?
It's not surprising, but it's disappointing for the very reasons that you're saying, right? In lots of ways, the story of any revolution is a story of what happens when outsiders become insiders, right? And now in lots of ways, Hamilton is in power and he's concerned about the fragility of the republic. He has tremendous anxiety about the people and the willingness of the people to be sort of roused up and led. And he's concerned that their presence will destroy the very country that he helped to create.
Yeah. Let me go back to you, Mallory. And you mentioned the sex scandal, and certainly that's part of the play and part of Alexander Hamilton's life. What was the scandal about?
Well, the scandal was about a woman named Mariah Reynolds had approached him, I think with a certain story that she had been left by her husband and child. I don't know if I'm getting that correct, Lewis, but that she was ditched by her husband and child, and she had gone to Alexander, knowing he was a good man, asked him for money. And then she had also let him know that other compensation was acceptable. And this affair, depending on where you read it, right, carried on for a number of years, and her husband had actually began to blackmail Alexander Hamilton into paying for him not to tell Hamilton's wife, Eliza. So that's dramatized in the musical very well, and with a lot of very devastating fall on the character of Alexander.
Well, and he writes the Reynolds pamphlet.
Yeah, and the reason why he writes this tells us a great deal about him. So it comes about because there's an investigation going on as to whether or not he committed fraud while he was Secretary of Treasury. James Monroe is one of the three investigators. This is going to play out in all kinds of complicated ways. And Hamilton is so incensed at the idea, because someone knows that he's been giving money and they think that the blackmail has to do with the Treasury Department, right, not with a private sexual scandal. So he comes out and he says, no, you know, it has nothing to do with my affairs in the Treasury Department. I was being blackmailed because I had an affair with this guy's wife, which led one of his political opponents to remark, oh, great, his defense is not that he's a swindler, but he's a rake, as if he thought that that was actually going to protect him. But it tells you something about
it. Sure does.
That sense of honor, that sense of pride, and this gets into dueling and other kinds of things,
sure,
that he was not going to allow anyone to cast aspersions upon his public role in American history.
Do you think, obviously with the advantage or perhaps disadvantage of hindsight, do you think he ever would have been president if he hadn't have been shot by Aaron Burr?
You know, that's impossible to say. I mean, he was young. Keep that in mind. I mean, he's born in 1755, right? Mm-hmm. And as we all know, political histories have second lives, third lives, and fourth lives. He helped destroy the Federalist Party, of which he was a member. He was never going to be a member of the Republican Party. So it wouldn't have come until sometime after the War of 1812, had he lived, if he had a sort of second act once the other so-called founders had run through. It's not impossible to think about, but certainly he would have made it difficult.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Lewis Mazur, and he's a professor of American Studies and History at Rutgers University. Mallory Cara is with us as well. She covers entertainment for Bustle.com, and we are talking about the musical Alexander Hamilton and about the real man Alexander Hamilton came to this country as a immigrant from the West Indies. He was about 14 or 15 years old, went on to become the first Treasury Secretary, a founding father. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Marilee, let's talk about the Schuyler girls or the sisters of the family, and Alexander Hamilton marries into this family. What do we learn about them from the musical?
Well, we learn that Alexander meets Angelica first, which is actually one of the major inaccuracies from the musical, that Alexander and Angelica meet, they trade wits, they fall in love, but Angelica instead sees that her sister Eliza is head over heels for him and says, you know what, I have to marry Rich, I'm the eldest, I'm going to let Eliza have him, and he'll still be in my life. Unfortunately, that, as Lewis can tell you, that's not entirely accurate at all. But there is a very strong connection between Angelica and Hamilton that goes throughout the years, many letters, and is, whether you want to believe it's consummated or not, is what? Up to you.
Believe, Lou, that this play has a kind of feminist cast to it, that the women are given really prominent roles.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, this isn't original with me. Others have said how the title Hamilton refers as much to Elizabeth as it does to Alexander. And I think that it's a really important aspect of the play, that she is such a central figure. And Chernow's book does this as well. It mm-hmm. opens and closes with Elizabeth's very long life.
And she lived to 90-something, right?
Yeah, exactly. She doesn't die until 1854, and she spends her whole life sort of defending mm-hmm. and supporting her husband's legacy, as well as creating an orphan asylum in New York. But I think the focus on the importance of women, the role of women, they may not have been involved in polity and public affairs, the ways in which we talk about the founding fathers, but these founding mothers and sisters played a critical role. As Abigail Adams famously said, remember the ladies, when she said to John Adams going off to the Revolution.
I read several things in preparation for the show about the Schuyler family. Were they slaveholders? Do we know?
They were.
And so he married into a family that had slaves.
And here's another interesting question about the real Hamilton. The play maybe overstates Hamilton's abolitionism. Now, again, this is about interpretation, not fact. It's clear Hamilton was a founder of the New York Manumission Society. It's clear he supported arming slaves to fight in the Revolution. He wasn't pro-slavery, but there's also evidence that he helped arrange for transfers of slaves for the sisters. He didn't, in all of his voluminous writings, there's very little about denouncing slavery as a moral institution. I mean, Franklin, at the end of his life, writes voluminously and extensively about the moral crime of slavery. So there is this slaveholding background in the family. Hamilton himself never owned slaves. That's clear. Right. And clearly he becomes anti-slavery, but that's not the same as making him into like a radical abolitionist.
Well, I was wondering about that, whether the play sort of has gone too far, because I think for some people that is a takeaway.
I think it goes a little too far, and Chernow as well emphasizes that in his biography. There are other historians who want to rein that interpretation in a little bit.
Let me get Ron from the University of Delaware to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Ron. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is actually to address the issue of whether Alexander Hamilton was biracial. His mother definitely was a black woman from the island of Nevis, who came to St. Croix, and that's where she supposedly married someone that may have been of Jewish background. But mm-hmm. Alexander Hamilton is definitely a man of biracial. He was the son of a plantation owner on Nevis who sent the mother to St. Croix. There are records in around St. Croix in the government records talking about Alexander Hamilton. Just about everything on the island of St. Croix was named after
That's
him.
That's interesting.
I'm a long time resident of the Virgin Islands also.
Well, that's interesting, Ron. And I've read several different accounts of this. I'm just looking at you, Lou. If we can ever know this or settle this question.
For now, all I can go by is Chernow's biography, which for now is the definitive biography. He went to the West Indies. He did research in the archives. He makes the argument that it's not the case, but in lots of these things, there won't be a definitive answer. It's the same thing with the question of Hamilton's homoerotic relationships with some men, for example, John Laurens. We know that the family edited out some letters. They destroyed some letters between them, that Hamilton had a certain effeminate manner. A lot of people recognize that in him. So how much of that is just 18th century styles of friendship versus how much is it something more? It's impossible to know.
Ron, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Mallory, we haven't really spent much time talking about Aaron Burr. How is he depicted in this play?
In this play, he is depicted as the terse, the succinct, and very cautious, cool kind of, but very succinct, very, very terse. Most of his catchphrases are very short. Wait for it, talk less, smile more. He's not someone who is, in comparison to Alexander, he's not rapping at, miles a minute. He's singing. He's waiting. Or something. He's waiting for a philosophy, which he finally does get at the end, middle of Act 2.
Yeah. What's nice about the play is that moment about wanting to be in the room, that sense of being a decision maker. And so the play sort of presents Burr also as an outsider who wants to be an insider. Of course, in reality, Burr wasn't that much of an outsider.
No.
He went to Princeton. His grandfather was Jonathan Edwards. He was well entrenched. But I think that what it really captures is Burr is completely unprincipled. He will flip-flop between political parties. He will do whatever he has to do to advance himself, whereas whatever the politics of Hamilton and Jefferson, they believed that they were advancing something larger than themselves.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about Hamilton the musical and Alexander Hamilton, our first Treasury Secretary. And that's Louis Mazur, Professor of American Studies and History at Rutgers University. Also with us, Mallory Kara, covers entertainment for Bustle.com. And we want to hear from you, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more music and conversation after this short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Let's hear another song from Hamilton. This is Nonstop, sung by Lin-Manuel Miranda as Hamilton and Philippa Sue as Eliza Schuyler Hamilton, Alexander's wife.
Alexander.
I have to leave.
Alexander.
Look around at how lucky we are to be alive right now.
Helpless.
They are asking Z to leave.
Look around, isn't this enough? People never be satisfied. People never be satisfied.
History has
Well, we're having fun listening to the music of Hamilton. And again, our guests are Mallory Kara and Louis Mazur. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Lou, you were telling me during the break there are several ways we can interpret that word shot. What is he actually, maybe perhaps it's a double entendre here.
I certainly think so. I mean, it's also anticipating the duel and the question of dueling in general and whether or not it was indeed Hamilton's intention when he reached the dueling ground with Burr to, as was often done during this code duello, just fire the shot up in the air to signal that he wasn't going to fire at the opposing party.
And just to reinforce those of us that have been in our history class for a while, what brought them together, Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton, for their duel?
Oh, well, I mean, one of the things about to understand is the duel wasn't that unusual. In fact, Chernow points out that Hamilton was involved in one way or another in perhaps as many as 10 duels. Very few of them, almost none of them, came to consummation. But this idea of defending one's honor, these affairs of honor, that if you were insulted, you needed to redress that. You couldn't allow that to stand. And recall Hamilton's own son was murdered in a duel only a few years before. Now, having said that, without going on and on and on about the details, what ends up happening is Burr hears a story that Hamilton was at a dinner party and that he said some despicable things about Burr. Now, Burr, as the aggrieved party, wants to know what those despicable things were. Now, what's interesting is Hamilton had always been on the other side. Hamilton was always the aggrieved party, going on and on and on, demanding redress and satisfaction, and often getting it. People would apologize. They would back down. The seconds would come in. It wouldn't ultimately lead to a duel. But here, Hamilton was the one being asked to apologize, and he wasn't very good at it. There's a moment where Burr writes to him. He says, I hear you've said some despicable things about me. And rather than Hamilton saying, you know, I'm sorry, none of them was really despicable, which you've ended, he says, well, it depends on what you mean by the word despicable, you know, is
very Hamiltonian. Yeah, is it not?
You know, if I called you a bastard, is that despicable? Right. And it just continues to go until Hamilton feels he just has no choice. Now, by this point, they hate each other because of political contretemps. Burr saw Hamilton as really denying him the presidency, as denying him the governorship of New York. And so that gets us to the dueling ground.
Mallory, there's a song from the musical, The Ten Duel Commandments. And there were, I think, rather strict rules about what you could or couldn't do if you had a duel. Can you speak to that particular song and sort of how it worked into the musical?
Sure. Actually, it was the format of the song is actually inspired by a Biggie Smalls song known as the Ten Crack Commandments. So the song itself has some roots in hip hop as well as having the roots in the American history of being the code of dueling, and a lot of those rules are very, very strict. There's sort of a gentleman's air about it. You have a second, you have a doctor on site, and you'll have the doctor turn around so he can, I'm quoting from the show, so he can claim deniability. You do not do this at night. You do this during the day. You mutually agree on the location. There was a lot of, you know, they did not take this lightly at all.
In fact, there were, I think, very fast. 25 rules, but it works better, obviously, and in a song to have them 10 because it fits with commandments, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. Let me read a Facebook comment from Karen. She says, in this week of the Orlando massacre, let's remember Hamilton wrote a Federalist paper, number 29, that explains the well-regulated militia in depth. Mm. Is that true?
He wrote extensively in the Federalist Papers about a variety of different topics. I mean, I don't know the details of his defense of the well-regulated militia. Of course, this ultimately gets into all kinds of arguments about the Second Amendment and ultimately what that means. And I think that's beyond the scope. It is clear that Hamilton, helped to create the Constitution, but the Bill of Rights actually comes from Jefferson, who reads the Constitution and wonders about it. Hamilton certainly supported broad constructions of the Constitution and is responsible for lots of those attempts of interpreting the Constitution broadly. The other thing Hamilton does in those Federalist Papers at some places is he talks about his suspicion of the people, that he doesn't trust the people, that he has lots of concerns about the virtue of the people. It's one of the reasons why he believed leaders needed to be from the elite and that he had his doubts about elections.
Well, in fact, he wanted or at some point wanted or proposed the idea of president for life.
That's correct.
Serve in the Senate for life. We do not think of these as democratic ideals. Did he have royalist leanings?
Jefferson certainly thought so, right? Jefferson saw him as a monarchist. And one of the divides between them is England versus France. And for Hamilton, it was England. It was the Bank of England. It was that system. It was aristocracy. But it was very common for the revolutionary generation to see in democracy what they called democratical despotism. The people couldn't be trusted. I think it's Hamilton's last letter, one of his last letters. He says our real disease is democracy, that's the poison. Because people he thought could be led away, could be swept away by ideologues and by others, and that unless you were a member of the elite, you had a sort of vested interest in society, that that couldn't happen. Just very quickly, in Federalist No. 17-1, since we're talking about the Federalist Papers, he says about the people that they are continually beset by the wiles of parasites and sycophants, by the snares of the ambitious, the avaricious, the desperate, by the artifices of men who possess their confidence more than they deserve it.
And this coming from a poor immigrant, the bastard, as you know, as he was described, coming to this country.
Correct.
With almost nothing.
Correct. But democracy doesn't become legitimized as the word that defines America until the 1830s with Jackson and Tocqueville. For these founders, especially on the Federalist side, they're very suspicious of the people.
Mallory, we have a web comment from Eileen, says, if only American history would be taught this way. And of course, we're correcting some of it. But nonetheless, the idea, I think, of Hamilton getting people thinking about the founding of the country, these founding fathers, some of the issues that we still grapple with today. It's a fascinating history lesson, and the fact that so many people are so enthused about the play and getting them thinking about our beginnings here.
Absolutely. I think what Hamilton does great is that it kind of sneaks in, like you don't realize that you're learning. There's a whole community on genius.com where people annotate every single line of dialogue where it relates to history, where to find it. And you kind of fall into an internet hole just looking at that and being fascinated that this stuff actually happened. It's not just something that is appearing on stage and in these incredible songs, that you can actually, there's roots in so much of this that are real events. And I think that's kind of the extra layer of entertainment to Hamilton, is that this is all real. A lot of this had happened or has inspiration from events that had actually happened. And when you learn more about it, I think Hamilton kind of allows you that entrance into, if you weren't into American history before, you were definitely into it now.
Well, and I assume that makes you very happy, Lou Mazur.
There are these moments once a generation where this kind of thing happens. You know, a lot of people recall Ken Burns' documentary on the Civil War in 1990, which on public television drew millions and millions of people and made them interested in the lives and the stories of the Civil War in the same way that now this play is doing. I think it's fantastic. And this conversation is important, though, because those are works of art.
Right.
The same thing with Steven Spielberg's movie on Lincoln. You know, I'm a Lincoln scholar, and I was thrilled that so many people suddenly became interested in Lincoln. But still, it's the job to understand it's a movie. It's not necessarily history, and we have to take those facts and understand the truths that emerge from them.
Let me get Tony from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Tony. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I'd like to mention the fact that we seem to have a problem of accepting whenever there are people of great accomplishments, if they are of mixed background, African-American, Native American, but particularly African-American, we seem to downplay and rewrite the history. And your guest there sort of blew off the gentleman who was from the islands who spoke about his grandmother and his mother. I mean, if your mother and your grandmother or whoever is of color, then you are of color to a great extent. We had a policy here in America that if you had one drop of black blood, you were considered black. Now, all of a sudden, you know, everybody is biracial or they're immigrants and so on and so forth. I just want to point out the fact, I mean, they're still begging the question about Jefferson and his mistress, even though the family took DNA tests. There's still people saying allegedly, you know. So I just wish we could just come to the fore and give acknowledgement where it is when it's positive. We're always doing the negative, but let's have the positive things.
Sure,
and
Tony.
Acknowledge if the man was, you know. Excuse me. I'm venting. I'm like,
No. You're not venting at all. You're raising an important question.
No, exactly.
And I know Lou wants
and
to respond.
Listen, I was not trying to blow it off anyway. I'm just going by the records.
One, you know, other person who wrote a book
that Chernow presents. My job as a historian is right. We have to establish evidence. So, yes, so the great work that Annette Gordon-Reed did on Jefferson now has even the most skeptical Jefferson scholars. Everyone has now acknowledged Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings. That history is now being rewritten to include Hemings, to include Hemings' family, to understand that Jefferson did that. Now, that just makes Jefferson a more complicated figure. It also gets us into the whole tortured history of race in America. In fact, you know, you use the word mistress to describe Jefferson's relationship with her. I would use the word rape. Mm-hmm. When a slaveholder had sexual relations with the enslaved, it gets very complicated as to understanding what the nature of that relationship is. So I agree with you completely. I think that these are fundamentally important questions about racial identity and sexual identity that we need to look into. At the same time, as historians, we need to view closely to what evidence we can find and suss through that material.
Tony, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Mallory, let me go to you. And for people that don't know this, I mean, the cast of Hamilton is the cast of minority actors. Basically, the only white person is King George, but everyone else is a person of color. One of the criticisms, though, I also read was that they are playing white people, but that there were African Americans or perhaps even slaves that played an important role in that history at that time, but not included in this particular musical. I don't want to get too deep into it because it's a bit of a side issue, but I saw that critique.
I have seen that too, and I know that that's definitely a major issue that the musical does not address. The musical is very rich in that it addresses so much information in a short amount of time. Right. But slavery is one of those issues that simmers below the surface. There are mentions of it. There's a big mention in the finale. It is there. It just does not become the major issue that it will become. And I'm very torn about it. Personally, I don't know how Hamilton could address it. Meanwhile, right, addressing the personal and professional struggles of the main character, as well as the country and all of everything that goes on in that time period. But I think what I love the most about the musical is that it does champion diversity, especially in a time where the Oscars don't necessarily, you know, Oscars So White had emerged, as well as a lot of other whitewashing controversies. So, you know, as well as I'm a minority myself, I did not grow up seeing many people of color on TV. And, you know, so it's very, I think it also helps to see these characters as people of today. A lot of times Hamilton is described as American History for Grown-Ups or the story of America then as told by America now. And I think that's the most accurate description of it.
Sure. Lou, we're almost out of time. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, I was just going to say the diverse cast is fantastic. I mean, one of the concerns is with top ticket prices at $854, the audience is not necessarily as diverse mm-hmm. as the cast. Now, Lin-Manuel Miranda has been fantastic about this in terms of providing tickets to New York City school children, in terms of providing cheaper tickets. But we would hope that over time, the audience who has an opportunity to see it will mirror the diversity of those on stage.
Well, my thanks to the two of you for joining us today on Radio Times. And we do want to close things out with another song from Hamilton, The World Was Wide Enough, sung by Leslie Odom Jr. as Aaron Burr following his duel with Hamilton.
Death doesn't discriminate between the sinners and the saints. It takes and it takes and it takes. History obliterates, and every picture it paints, it paints me and all my mistakes. When Alexander aimed at the sky, he may have been the first one to die, but I'm the one who paid for it. I survived, but I paid for it. Now I'm the villain in your history. I was too young and blind to see. I should have known. I should have known the world was wide enough for both Hamilton and me. The world was wide enough for both Hamilton and me.